I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, James Woolsey, has a history of, let's just call it, interesting takes on matters related to U.S. foreign policy and national security threats. A member of the now defunct, but in its time, notoriously hawkish neoconservative think tank, the Project for a New American Century, Woolsey has banged the drum on such subjects as the alleged threat of electromagnetic pulse weapons that could, he says, be used against the United States by countries like North Korea and Iran. He's also been a proponent of the idea that elements of Saddam Hussein's Iraq, as well as Al-Qaeda, were involved in the Oklahoma City bombing. Most recently, however, Woolsey has turned his attention to the long-standing debate about the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Was it the work of a lone nut or a conspiracy? In the new book, Operation Dragon, Woolsey argues, in a way, that it was a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B. He alleges that Soviet Union leader Nikita Khrushchev had ordered Lee Harvey Oswald to kill President Kennedy, but shortly thereafter called off the plot in fear that it would eventually be discovered and lead directly back to him. What Khrushchev didn't count on, according to Woolsey, is that Oswald would go rogue and carry out the assassination anyways. So, even though the book doesn't say that the Soviet Union committed the assassination, it does argue that Kennedy's death was in no small part the result of alleged nefarious and highly treacherous activities on the part of the Soviet Union. Joining us to dissect Operation Dragon and to put it in the context of Woolsey's career, his associations with neoconservatism, and the triumph of what sociologist C. Wright Mills called crackpot realism in U.S. foreign policy, is returning guest Jim DiEugenio of the website Kennedys and King, and the writer of the upcoming Oliver Stone documentary, JFK Revisited, Through the Looking Glass. Jim has written a review of Operation Dragon that is now available at Kennedys and King. Our conversation begins with Jim giving updates on the potential declassification and release of the remaining JFK documents. We then turn our attention to James Woolsey and his book, Operation Dragon, which ends up bringing us to a broader conversation about U.S. foreign policy and the triumph of neoconservatism, or again, crackpot realism within those circles. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. Welcome back to Parallax Views, a guest that I've been probably asking on too much. I'm taking up too much of his time, but I love my conversations with him. Jim DiEugenio of Kennedy's and King. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing okay, JG. Thanks for inviting me back.
So, Jim, maybe you could tell my listeners, what's new at Kennedy's and King right now? I know you have a review up of John Newman's latest writings on JFK, and also there's some developments with the JFK records.
Yes. Let me talk about that a little bit, because I don't think enough people know about this, and it's disgracefully ignored by the mainstream media, which a lot of things are. In 2017, Donald Trump was supposed to release the last of the JFK records. And this was actually written into the law, all right? It was actually written into the law, the JFK Act, all right? And he announced a couple weeks before that he was looking forward to doing this, all right? It's one of his famous tweets, right? Well, come the day that he was supposed to do it, I believe it was October 25th or October the 26th, he was visited by the CIA and the FBI. And lo and behold, he delayed the release of the documents, not once, but twice. First, the delay was for 6 months. They were supposed to be going through a review. Now, let me ask you a question. If the review board became inactive in 1998, and we're talking about 2017, don't you think that 20 years is enough to review the documents?
Yeah, no doubt.
I think most people would believe that you could have reviewed them page by page, you know, in that length of a time. Well, Donald Trump said, we're going to give you 6 more months. And then what happened then is he then extended that for 3 more years. But not only that, he literally changed the law. All right, we have an attorney down in Florida, a guy named Mark Adamczyk in Naples, who's done just a wonderful job, you know, going through the records and the law on this. See, the JFK Act said that if you're going to defer any documents, there had to be a written explanation as to why you were doing so. Only the president could do this, right? Well, guess what? Trump, who's kind of famous for not abiding by his agreements, all right, didn't do that. There was no written explanation for each document as to why they were going to be deferred again. All right. And secondly, he kind of tried to switch the responsibility for the declassification from himself to the National Archives. The problem with that is that the National Archives really doesn't make any decisions about what to declassify. They only do this at the behest of other agencies, or if there's a lawsuit, and they go ahead, or the third way they do it is by what they call a timed release. If there's a date on the document when it's supposed to be declassified, they will do so, as they were going to do here. They were going to do this in 2017. They even announced, we're letting go of all these JFK documents as stipulated by the law in October of 2017. And they announced that in April. So in other words, the CIA and the FBI and the State Department, right with that announcement, has 6 months to review right there, all right? So now what Trump did, he now made this decision landing on Joe Biden's desk, all right? And so there's going to be a recommendation by the Public Classification Review Board. I think that will be coming out on Monday, all right? And then Biden has 1 month to go ahead and decide if he's finally going to let go of all these documents. Now, I ask you, if Oswald did it, isn't 58 years enough? Yeah. I would think most rational people would believe that such was the case.
I was just going to add to that. I think it's been interesting speaking with people like Larry Schnapp, who is also working on the JFK documents, the JFK records, as you know. But for my listeners, I recently interviewed Larry Schnapp. I've interviewed Jefferson Morley in the past year. And what I find really interesting is not only is this not being covered by the mainstream media, but generally speaking, I think there's a lot of support for declassification of these records, even from people who support the official story. I mean, I think Larry Schnapp was telling me that, you know, Gerald Posner was open to getting the documents released and called for that.
Yes. But
Liosi did before he died. That's what Morley told me. And you don't even see that in the media.
Right. And also, from what my understanding from Mark is that Robert Blakey is going to be writing an editorial, an op-ed, that I think is going to be in some of the major newspapers. And Oliver Stone is also going to write one. Okay, and that's going to be coming out, I think, next month. So I really don't think that it's possible to find very many people who are opposed to the final declassification of these documents. And by the way, it's not just a few. Okay, it's the last tally I saw, it's well over 15,000 pages of documents that are either classified in full, or what they call this famous word that they use, redacted, okay? Which means certain parts of the document are blacked out. And it's usually, from my experience, there's always a key portion of the document that makes you understand the rest of the document that gets blacked out. You know, as Robert Tannenbaum once said, redactions, you know what that means, right? Up here, you have a document that says the investigation of. Down at the bottom, you have Lee Harvey Oswald. Everything else is black. Okay, so this is what we got. And for the life of me, I cannot understand, you know, why the mainstream media is not interested in this. If you recall, in 2017, when Trump announced he was going to release the documents, there was some interest. There was on cable TV, sometimes even on network TV. I remember an ABC report. You know, we're finally going to get to see the last of the JFK documents. And CNN did shows on this. Then all of a sudden, when Trump finally backed down, what happened? There was a blackout. Nobody said anything. Nobody even reported on why Trump did what he did, okay, and what the legal rationale was for it. Well, we now have the legal rationale. Mark has written about it. Trump got somebody in the Department of Justice, some lawyer, to go ahead and write a memo, which essentially alters the law. You know, and why people aren't up in arms about this really escapes me completely, all right? It's very puzzling.
I also wanted to get your take on this because I feel like people have forgotten about it. But when it comes to Donald Trump, you know, for a long time, you know, in the early stages of his presidency and his run, he was sort of Mr. There's more to the JFK assassination, you know, going after Ted Cruz's father and all this other stuff that he did. And also, you know, being associated with Roger LBJ did everything bad in the world Stone. What do you think about the way Trump sort of portrayed himself as wanting the truth about JFK? I feel like he actually may have muddied the waters a bit.
You know, I have to say, you know, it's very puzzling in that aspect because you're utterly correct. He did go after Ted Cruz, okay, for saying erroneously that was his father in a street scene with Oswald in New Orleans in the summer of 1963. And then he, of course, did have this, whatever you want to call it, this informal alliance with Roger Stone, who wrote a couple of books, you know, which questioned the official story on the JFK case. Then, all of a sudden, he does this turnaround, whatever you want to call it, pirouette, all right? And he more or less, and I don't think there's any other word for it, he more or less chickened out, you know, of going up against the CIA and the FBI. And by the way, he never explained why he changed his mind. At least I've never seen any explanation in public of why he did this pirouette on this issue. So we're at complete kind of a black hole as to why Trump did this, you know, and he doesn't want to, obviously he doesn't want to talk about it. And the media isn't asking him any questions about it, you know. And so here we are. Like I said, there's going to be an announcement, I think, on Monday. And then Biden has a month to go ahead and make up his mind on this. And hopefully we'll have those two guys, you know, writing op-eds in the major media. All right. So let's keep our fingers crossed. And by, let me add one last thing before we get to the other subject. All right. In my opinion, it doesn't matter what's in the documents, okay? It doesn't matter if it's important. It doesn't matter if it's not important. It doesn't matter if it's middling stuff, if it's, you know, mildly interesting, okay? What matters is this is the law, okay? And when presidents do this, okay, when they break their word, when they defy acts of Congress. And by the way, Biden was in on the JFK Act. He was in the Senate Judiciary Committee when the JFK Act was passed. All right, when presidents do this, this creates a real aura of cynicism, of skepticism about who's really running the country. And in my opinion, and I can back this up, this all began in 1964. If you read the graphs of when public disillusion with government began, it began in 1964 with the release of the Warren Commission report, all right? And now it's continuing, okay? You know, it got worse and worse with Watergate and Vietnam, okay? And there's been no real reinforcement or no real reimbursement on that. And now it's going to hit its nadir next month if Biden does not release these last of these JFK documents.
So any other updates you have from Kennedy's and King? I know there's the new John Newman book out. I don't know if you could just briefly tell
listeners about that. That's actually not a new book.
I thought he had a new one coming out. Okay.
Now he does have a new one coming out. But that's a different book. That's called Armageddon. All right. And I think that's coming out in a month or two. Okay. I reviewed his last, he's doing this multi-long series, which is either going to be 5 or 6 volumes. All right. And I reviewed volume 3, okay, which is called Into the Storm. As you know, I've been very busy on Oliver Stone's upcoming documentary about the JFK case. So I didn't have enough time to read that book. Okay, I did review his update of JFK in Vietnam, and now I finally had time to review this volume 3, Into the Storm. Now, he's already supposedly going to release his 4th volume, which is upcoming, like I said, shortly. Now, concerning Oliver, he did an interview with Dennis Bernstein, okay? I think Dennis Bernstein is Pacifica in San Francisco, all right? And he did it for Counterpunch, all right? The journal that, as we all know, the late Alexander Coburn founded. It's a very interesting interview, okay? And in that interview, he says the film is going to be released in November. That's all he said. He didn't say where, he didn't say how, etc. He said the film is going to be released in November. Okay? So that's all I can say. Right? Even though I wrote the screenplay.
Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing that. I'm glad Counterpunch covered it. I know Counterpunch hasn't always released the kind of materials on JFK that a lot of people at Kennedy's and King would like, but I'm glad they're giving Ollie some coverage.
Well, they're kind of schizoid on the whole issue. In fact, I've written several columns about how bad their stuff is, but every once in a while they do something that's okay, right?
Hey there, Parallax News listeners. Before we continue our conversation on this edition of Parallax Views, I want to notify California listeners of the program about one of our sponsors, the therapy practice of Alexander Yu. Yu is an experienced teletherapist since 2008, and he goes by the motto, Flow, Adapt, Change, as Lao Tzu would say. And he wants to accompany you on your journey of self-improvement. Now, again, this applies to California listeners of the program. Alexander is a licensed psychotherapist and teletherapist. And if you'd like his services, then please contact him at Alexander U. That's Alexander U. YOO.com. And he can be reached by email at therapy@alexanderu.com or by phone at 323-834-9828. That's 323-834-9828. This is only available once again to my California listeners, but if you need anything related to therapy needs, please be sure to contact our sponsor, Alexander Yu. So the main reason I wanted to have you on is this book that came out a while back called Operation Dragon by James Woolsey. And I believe it, there's a co-author that I'm blanking that isn't on the, it's on the tip of my tongue, but in any case, this book, Operation Dragon, what is the theory it's proposing? And I guess who is James Woolsey for people that may be unfamiliar? He was the CIA director, I believe, under Clinton for a few years.
James Woolsey was rose to, I think, admiral status in the Navy. Okay. He then worked on strategic arms limitations. And then Clinton appointed him as CIA director. But from what I understand, and I wrote this in the article, they didn't have a close relationship. And in fact, some people have told me since I wrote the article, they never met face to face at any kind of meeting. And in fact, further I discovered, other people told me, that Clinton never wanted Woolsey as a CIA director. But in some kind of pre-election deal, all right, he had to go ahead and appoint him. Now, if you know anything about Woolsey, especially his career since, because he left the CIA, I think, in 1993. If you know anything about Woolsey, to put it mildly, and something I went into in the article, the neocon movement began with the Republican Party, and most people trace it back to Rumsfeld and Cheney during the Ford administration. Okay. Plus George H.W. Bush as a CIA director who covered up for the CIA during the Church Committee hearings. Right. The reason most people trace it to that is because these guys actually, and this is hard to believe, and I hope you're sitting down when you hear this, but it's true. These guys actually thought that Henry Kissinger was too liberal, which to me is, you know, mind-boggling if you know anything about Kissinger. But they did not like the idea that Nixon and Kissinger had, which was to try and create a detente with the Soviet Union, right? And so they rebelled against this. And this was really the beginning of the neocon movement, which then spread, and it's hard to believe, but it's true. It then spread into the Democratic ranks. And so Woolsey, I believe, if you read this book, is clearly part of this whole neocon movement.
Well, I believe he actually has documented ties to things like the big neoconservative think tank.
Yes.
The Project for a New American Century.
He was in that. He was in that. I didn't know that till I wrote this review, that he was part of PNAC, you know, the infamous PNAC that really wanted to provoke this senseless and fraudulent war with Saddam Hussein. And he actually was on the board of PNAC when they went ahead and signed a letter and tried to get Clinton to go ahead and provoke a war in the Middle East, all right? Now, if you recall what happened, is that when this actually occurred, PNAC mysteriously disappeared from the face of the earth, and they tried to deny, oh no, we really didn't mean that stuff, okay, you know, all right. But Woolsey was a part of that, okay? And I could discover that, you know, researching this article, all right? That's how far right in foreign policy that Woolsey has gone, all right? And because of this, I believe, and the guy you were thinking of is, I think, Ion Pisipa, who was the head of intelligence in Romania, and he defected in the late 1970s. That's the co-author, who's since deceased, all right? This book tries to say, against all kind of logic and rules of evidence, that somehow, some way, the Soviets went ahead, recruited Oswald, and went ahead and decided to employ Oswald in the assassination of President Kennedy under Nikita Khrushchev. Like Edward Epstein, it then says that somehow Khrushchev changed his mind, but Oswald went ahead and stayed the course. And this, at the end, he was under the influence of Cuban intelligence. All right. So in other words, here you have a neocon dream, all right, that somehow, some way, the communists were behind Oswald's shooting of JFK. Now, let me explain something else about this, which I think is important. And I wrote about this in the article. Pisipa was probably the first of these guys who defected from the communist bloc and then were working for and with the CIA. Now, I'm not saying there wasn't anybody before. You know, there were people like Golitsyn. There were people like Mosenko. All right, there were people like Lysenko. But in the years that followed, there began to be a literal wave of these guys, all right? And it began a few years later with the fall of the Berlin Wall, okay? And the fact that Gorbachev could not get any traction in his attempt to create a detente with the United States, right? And so people began to see the writing on the wall, and you got a wave of these defectors from these communist countries, especially the former Soviet Union. And they began, like, for instance, Matryokhin, okay? All right, and they began to, what's really funny about this, Amy Wright, a Russian scholar up in Canada, wrote an interesting article about this. And she says, isn't it odd that all these defectors brought notes? Are we supposed to believe that in the entire KGB headquarters, anywhere, any place, there wasn't a copying machine that they could use to copy these documents and bring them with them? But as I wrote in my article about it, what was so interesting about these guys is they essentially gave the CIA and the State Department what they wanted. In other words, there wasn't just a small circle of Soviet spies in the United States. Okay, they try, in this book, Operation Dragon, they try and say that Oppenheimer was a Soviet spy. And they base that on one of these Russian defectors. So I called up Peter Kuznick, who co-wrote Untold History of the United States with Oliver Sohn. And I asked him, I said, I've never heard of this, you know, that Oppenheimer was a Soviet spy who gave out the secrets to the KGB. And he goes, Jim, the worst thing, you never heard of it, because there isn't any rational evidence that says Oppenheimer was such a spy. Okay.
I just wanted to add very briefly here, this all brings to mind, you know, the sort of frenzied right-wing paranoid, I would say fantasies, that a figure like the CIA's James Angleton had, you know, the whole idea of the monster plot, you know,
right.
The commies are everywhere. They've infiltrated completely. You know?
Right, exactly. You know, I laugh about it, but it's not really funny, you know, when you think about it. See, these guys, and this was my punchline in the article, they really want to bring back Cold War I. That is the one we have, you know, the war against terror isn't enough. All right, they want to bring back the first Cold War, which most people believe started in about 1946 with the so-called Long Telegram by George Kennan, and then lasted all the way to the coming of Gorbachev. All right, you know, and so they want to bring this all back. And so Oppenheimer now becomes a Soviet spy. And so when I asked Peter about this, okay, he said, Jim, you know, and Peter has studied the whole atomic age as much as anybody has, and I consider him an expert on this.
Peter was actually just on my show last month. I respect.
Oh, he was?
Yes.
Oh, okay, good. He's a very good guy. And so he said, Jim, there's, you know, look, I've read a lot about Oppenheimer, okay, and no, there's no evidence that he was a Soviet spy. The two main sources for the Soviets in the creation of their version of the atomic bomb was Klaus Fuchs and a guy named Theodore Hall, okay? And Theodore Hall, we just learned about him a few years ago in this book called Bombshell, all right? And so, and they actually, the authors of that book actually talked to Hall, and he admitted this, okay, that he not only gave away secrets of the atom bomb, but he also gave a whole roster of the people who were working on it, okay? So yes, it was Hall and Fuchs who were the two most important people, okay, who were Soviet agents. And you know, just use common sense. If it had been Oppenheimer, the Soviets would have had everything, because Oppenheimer was essentially the number one guy in the whole program. It would have taken him 4 years, you know, to create an atomic bomb. They would have had utterly everything that they would have needed, you know, because of his high placement in the program. Now, everybody knows, of course, well, maybe not everybody, but everybody knows, of course, that Oppenheimer then had a kind of, you know, showdown at high noon with Teller about whether or not the United States should proceed with the hydrogen bomb. You know, Oppenheimer did not think that that was necessary at all. Okay, Teller did, and Truman ended up backing Teller. All right. Now, what most people don't know is that John F. Kennedy, because Truman then revoked Oppenheimer's clearance, okay, John F. Kennedy named Oppenheimer to give him an award at the White House in the fall of 1963. Okay, Kennedy was killed before he could actually give the award, but Johnson then went ahead and carried out his wishes, probably the only time he did, okay, and he gave him that award, all right? So this is a big part of the book, that it wants to create this wide-ranging plot, okay? Oh, I left out an important part. Clement Attlee is named as a Soviet spy. Clement Attlee became the Prime Minister of England in a huge upset over Winston Churchill at the end of World War II. Clement Attlee is usually considered, most historians consider him, one of the most preeminent and illustrious prime ministers in British history, okay? Because he did so much to nationalize certain industries, socialize, make a movement for socialized medicine, et cetera. He was a very liberal kind of a guy, especially when you can compare him to what Churchill was. All right, and so now in these former KGB agents' hands, Clement Attlee now becomes, and let me make a referral to this. I think that's a very good comparison you made, because as most people know, Golitsyn tried to sell Angleton on this so-called monster plot that the Soviets had infiltrated not just the United States, but also England and France, all right? And they had Soviet spies everywhere. And in fact, I guess to say he tried to sell them is too mild. He did sell them on this. Angleton started to look for spies everywhere in the United States and its allies. And what's so important about Operation Dragon is that it fulfills Golitsyn's design. It helps do that. It says that somehow Joe McCarthy was right, okay?
I almost feel, not to interrupt you, but the more I learn about this book, the more I think to myself, is this like on the Book of the Month Club for the John Birch Society?
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say. This is what the John Birch Society said. If you remember, the John Birch Society even tried to say Eisenhower was a communist agent. Okay? You know? And so that's what Operation Dragon does. It somehow fulfills this design that if anything, the United States underestimated the treachery and the success of the Soviets in the Cold War. Now, let me say this. The idea that somehow Oswald was working for the KGB begins, of course, with James Angleton. Angleton tried to sell this idea that somehow, some way, that Oswald was a KGB agent. Angleton's disciple, Edward Epstein, right, then wrote a book about this called Legend. If you recall, Legend was purchased for pre-sale serialization by Reader's Digest, okay, in a very big deal, all right? In fact, Reader's Digest was a main contributor to the book. They gave Epstein a huge advance. You know, I'm talking Today, it would be in the millions, okay? And Epstein had like 12 assistants, okay, working on the research of that book. One of the assistants talked to Jim Mars, the late Jim Mars. And Jim Mars asked her, you know, why didn't you look for the CIA influence in Roswell? And the girl said, we were told not to do that. Okay. So the book focused on George DeMorin's show. And they tried to paint George DeMorin's show as a KGB agent. And that's what Operation Dragon does. It brings back legend. It brings back Epstein's legend. It's like an echo from the past. And it brings back this concept. All right, but the problem is, and I think anybody knows anything about the Kennedy assassination would know this, that DeMorin Schell admitted that he would have never even met Oswald if he wasn't instructed to do so by a CIA handler who was J. Walton Moore in the Dallas CIA office, all right? So then if you follow Oswald, what happens? He gets associated with these white Russians in Dallas, okay, who are sponsored by the CIA, the Tolstoy Foundation, which is a CIA front. Then when Oswald goes to New Orleans, what happens? He gets involved with these Cuban exiles and people like David Ferry, Guy Bannister, and Clay Shaw, who are all associated with the CIA. And then he comes back to Dallas, and he's friendly with the Paines, with Ruth and Michael Paine, who are, at the very least, FBI friendly. All right? We don't know about the CIA yet. Maybe that's in these documents. Okay? You know? But so that whole aspect of Oswald was left out. And by the way, we know today, we knew this a long time ago, one of Angleton's prime consultants on legend was James Angleton. Okay? So what...
You mean one of... I think you said one of Angleton's prime consultants. You mean one of Epstein's prime consultants was Angleton.
Epstein consulted with Angleton on that book, on legend. Yes, I know that from Jerry Polakoff, a former reporter, who called up Angleton, all right, and he asked him directly, you know, did you consult with Epstein on that book, Legend? And Angleton admitted, yes, I talked to Epstein for hours on end, you know, about that book, all right? So we know this for a fact. And so what Operation Dragon does, it essentially tries to bring this back, all right? This whole crazy idea, okay, that somehow Oswald was in cahoots with at first the KGB and then G2, Cuban intelligence, in order to go ahead and assassinate Oswald. Now, as I wrote,
what would be the motive for this? Okay,
that's what I'm going to get to right now. Now, the problems with this, as I outline in my essay, is, first of all, why would the Soviets do this if at the time Kennedy was working on a detente with Khrushchev? All right. And this was facilitated through Norman Cousins, the editor of the Saturday Review. And it's written about by James Douglas in his book, JFK and the Unspeakable. All right. And according to Khrushchev's biographer, Mr. Taubman, okay, when Khrushchev went to the American embassy in Moscow, he was blinking back tears, okay, when he went to sign his respects to President Kennedy. So this makes utterly no sense. And in fact, as we know, Robert Kennedy and Jackie Kennedy wrote a letter to Moscow And they got it through their aide, William Walton. And they sent it to Georgi Bolshakov, right, who Robert Kennedy knew. And they intended it for Khrushchev to see, which he did. And in that letter, they wrote him and they said, we know that President Kennedy is working on a detente with the Soviet Union at the time of his death. We both believe that Lyndon Johnson, because he is so beholden to big business, will not be able to continue this, right? I, referring to Robert Kennedy, will resign my position as Attorney General, right? And then I will run for political office in the United States. And then I will run for president after that. At this time, we will then be able to continue our quest for detente, right? Now, I don't see how it gets more clear than that. I really, really don't. All right. And so, and of course, there was President Kennedy's famous peace speech that he made at American University, which is very clear what he's trying to do with that speech, which I think is in June of 1963. All right. So as far as the Russians go, especially Khrushchev, right? I don't think it's a coincidence that Khrushchev fell 1 year after Kennedy was killed, right? He was deposed by the hardliners in the Soviet Union, right? As for Castro, my God, I don't see how you can get more nutty than that, okay? I mean, we know that Castro, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, got in contact with Kennedy's representative, lawyer James Donovan, all right, and he told him that he would be interested in negotiations about a rapprochement, because this is right after the missile crisis, and Castro really did not like the fact that Khrushchev had essentially left him out of the peace negotiations, the truce negotiations, over that whole conflagration. And so Kennedy pursued this through people like William Atwood, Lisa Howard, and journalist John Donnell. This went on for months. And when William Atwood was interviewed by the Church Committee, he said, yes, I was a secret go-between between the White House and Castro. He later said that he had very little doubt that if those negotiations would have continued, which they did not under Johnson, that there would have been some kind of diplomatic recognition between Kennedy and the Cuban government in Havana. All right. Now, why on earth, and we have this right from John Danielle's mouth, because he was with Castro when the news came on the radio down in Havana that Kennedy had been killed. And according to Danielle, Castro was thunderstruck. Okay? His hands fell into his face, and he said three times, this is bad news. This is bad news. This is bad news. He then got the phone call saying that Kennedy was now dead about a half an hour later. And Danielle said, Castro came back to me and he told me what had happened. He said, everything is going to now change. And I mean, everything is now going to change. Which it did, okay, which it did. Castro tried to pursue that rapprochement with Johnson. It didn't work. Now, you know what Woolsey says? I mean, this is unbelievable. Woolsey says that Castro was play-acting during that whole scene, all right? And I'll tell you, Danielle writes about this so eloquently that if Castro was play acting, he should have gotten the Cuban version of the Academy Award, because he sure as heck sold Danielle on how upset he was about what had happened. And previously, in Kennedy's message to Danielle that he relayed to Castro, Castro was overjoyed at this message, right? He said words of the effect, finally, an American president comes along who understands the importance of class in economics. And then he said, you know something? Kennedy will now go down in history as the greatest American president since Abraham Lincoln. All right. So in other words, according to Operation Dragon, that was all play acting by Fidel Castro. And when Khrushchev was blinking back tears at the American embassy, that was play acting also. Now, let me have just a couple more minutes here. I want to add one other thing. We know today, and I've said this 50 times, right, that the revelations in what the review board declassified makes the fact that the Warren Commission and the House Select Committee came to the false conclusion that Oswald shot Kennedy. Okay, this is complete mythology, right? And if the film gets released, people will see what we base this on. So that's the other part of this that is so skewered. Finally, the last part of the equation is that because of the declassified work of Betsy Wolf of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, we know that the whole routing system for Oswald's files into the CIA, the normal procedure was bypassed. The routing files came into the CIA at the Mail Logistics Department. And instead of going to where they should have gone, which was the Soviet Russia Division, they went to the Office of Security. What that did is it guaranteed that there would be no 201 file open on Oswald. And there was not a 201 file opened on Oswald for 13 months. When Richard Helms was told this, he said, that's kind of amazing. Because, of course, the 201 file is the most common file in the agency. The fact that Oswald was a defector, the fact that there was all kinds of paper coming into the CIA, necessitated the opening of a 201 file. Somebody rigged the system. When Tenet Begley, who was a counterintelligence officer for the CIA for something like 23 years, saw a diagram of that routing system. He was shown it by Malcolm Blunt, the brilliant British researcher. Begley took a look at that diagram, and in about 10 seconds, he looked up at Malcolm and he said, all right, was he witting or unwitting? And Malcolm said, you mean as a defector? And he goes, yeah. And he goes, well, how would I know that? I can't answer that question. He goes, yes, you do. Go ahead. And Malcolm said, okay, unwitting. And Begley immediately replied, no, he had to have been a witting defector. Okay, the way this whole thing was set up. All right. So Operation Dragon, of course, doesn't mention any of this stuff. It doesn't mention any of the declassifications of the ARB, all right? And so therefore, what happens is people like James Woolsey go on Newsmax, okay, and they're allowed to go ahead and utter this BS, all right, with no challenges from anyone.
So what I wanted to add, and the reason I wanted to have you on, is because, you know, I've been following Woolsey's crap for a long time, and he writes a lot of crap even before this book. I'm actually looking at an article right now from the Wall Street Journal, where he argues that electromagnetic pulse weapons are coming, and that we're going to be attacked by North Korean electromagnetic pulse weapons. And the other thing is, and this ties into his whole neocon thing, is, and I can't believe anyone still believes this, but Woolsey was a big promoter of this idea that the Oklahoma City bombing was done in part by Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, the third terrorist theory of Yana Davis. And, you know, a lot of neocons pushed that particular theory, and it makes no sense, because I don't think jihadist terrorists would attack some federal building in Oklahoma City. It's complete hogwash, but he has a track record for promoting really, really, I would say, kook thinking, kook ideas.
Well, I'm not an expert in Oklahoma City, but the idea that something like that was pulled off by Al-Qaeda, okay, at the time that this happened, which, okay, you know, the fact that Woolsey would promote such a thing, I mean, I just don't see any of the logic behind that. It's really
Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein.
Well, but wait a minute. I thought Hussein was against Arab terrorism. In fact, he kind of went to war with them inside his own country. So he teamed up with this. Wow. Okay. I mean, that is just, you know. But see, that's the kind of thing that somebody like Woolsey, who wrote a book like this, you know, would go in for. Now, what's the other thing you said about electromagnetic weapons?
He has a whole article at, here it is, Wall Street Journal. He has an article called "The Growing Threat from an EMP Attack." And the subheadline is, "A nuclear device detonated above the U.S. could kill millions, and we've done almost nothing to prepare," by R. James Woolsey and Peter Vincent Pry. That's from the Wall Street Journal in 2014. And I think he talks about North Korea in that. He thinks North Korea is going to attack us with electromagnetic pulse weapons.
And
it's like, it's like John Carpenter's. Yeah, it's from 2014. It's like something out of a John Carpenter Escape from New York type movie.
Wow. I mean, today, North Korea can't hit, I think they'd be lucky to hit Hawaii. You know, okay, the idea that they could do that over a 48-state huge population center, that kind of advanced technology, I mean, holy Jesus. See, that this whole thing that the neocons have done, and the godfather was Paul Nitze, okay? Paul Nitze was intent on using the Cold War as a device to literally, and he wrote something like this, scare the hell out of the American people, all right? And so that would then go ahead and create a huge national defense buildup. And as we know, NSC 68, which was one of the pillars of this whole thing, it worked just the way Nitze wanted it to, okay? And Truman began to go ahead and build up a national defense, all right, which Eisenhower then went ahead and increased. But even Eisenhower, if people recall, and anybody who's seen JFK will recall this, you know, even he, at the end of his second term, warned about this. You know, it's a very good speech by him. It's called his farewell address, in which he warned about the what's going to happen if America gets swallowed up by what he called the military-industrial complex. Well, I don't think there's any question that he was right about that, and that the people like Nitze, who masqueraded as a Democrat, you know, and those guys won. There's no question about that. And I should, let me add one other point about this. The neocon movement, which Woolsey is clearly, as you mentioned, these two stories, you know, one of the scariest things about it is that how, although it began as a Republican invention, you know, a really large part of the Democratic Party, you know, has now, you know, I would have no problem saying that Hillary Clinton was a neocon.
Well, I mean, at the very least, Hillary Clinton wanted to out-hawk the Republican hawks.
Yeah. Right. I mean, when she wanted to invade Syria, you know, and she did invade Libya. All right. And that was an utter and complete disaster. Okay. All right. And then that wasn't enough for her. She wanted to invade Syria. Now, very briefly, why would anybody want to invade a secular state in the Middle East? Okay. Why? It makes no sense to invade a secular state because you run the risk of turning it into a fundamentalist state, all right, which is what happened in Libya. You know, Gaddafi called up Tony Blair twice when this was happening. You know, the NATO bombing and the rebellion that took place in the eastern part of Libya. And he told him, he said, look, this is not a rebellion. This is Al-Qaeda. If they win, Libya is going to be an operation of theirs, not in just North Africa, but they will be able to cross the Mediterranean Sea, which they did with the attacks on France. And he warned about that. But see, that wasn't enough for Hillary Clinton. She wanted to go ahead and invade Syria. And although Obama turned that down, what he did is he approved the CIA operation Timber Sycamore, which was a giant CIA operation, which was joined in by the British. And let me put it this way. When Putin turns out to be the good guy, I think you have problems. Okay. He's the one who recognized that if this thing worked, Syria would then turn into another Arab fundamentalist state and be very close to the Russian border. All right. And so that this is what happened. And this is how nutty these neocons are. This is all, if you look back, this is all an extension of PNAC, okay, which was a combined operation of both Republicans and Democrats.
And this all is right. Before, just so people know, the Project for a New American Century, this think tank was around before 9/11, and it was writing about right. We need a pretext for war in Iraq. I mean, they were right. Sort of planning out what they wanted for the Middle East years right. In advance.
Right. And they were actually very clear about it. You know, they actually said the whole Eurasian sector of that area, the Middle East, Afghanistan, et cetera, that the United States needs to have a military presence there. Okay. And for whatever reason, I don't know. Okay. I've never been able to figure out the logic of the Project for the New American Century.
I always loved, you know, the ex-CIA analyst, retired CIA analyst, Ray McGovern. Tells this story about how he was briefing H.W. Bush. And Bush referred to the neocons as the crazies in the basement of Middle East policy. And I you know what? I think it's true. I mean, they're kind of like, they're a berserker archetype almost.
Well, if you the difference is that H.W. Bush would not allow to go into and displace Hussein. He would not allow that. The difference is with W is he was one of them. He not only invaded it, he demanded that Hussein be overthrown. And if you remember, when the UN tried to get a truce, and they were getting a truce, okay, that Bush wouldn't accept that. he wouldn't accept a kind of, okay, let's check all their weapons. We'll check all their gas, their poison gas stuff. We'll be allowed to get in. And Hussein actually agreed to that. Okay, but Bush and Blair turned that down. And it was very clear in the Downing Street memo that this was their aim from the beginning, to fix the intelligence. If you remember, that was the phrase. Okay, so we can get an invasion of Iran. And this is clearly, I mean, you really don't even do have to do that much work. This was all part of the whole PNAC agenda, the Project for the New American Century, their agenda. And I totally agree with what H.W. Bush said. You know, and by the way, this goes back to C. Wright Mills when he was talking about what he called in foreign policy. The phrase he used was crackpot realism. Okay, that's what he called it. And I
wish crackpot realism was a more, it's not as used much as Mill's other term, power elite. We need to like reintroduce that term.
Right, it's exactly correct. Crackpot realism. I mean, crackpot realism is the thing that gives us people like James Woolsey. You know,
I just wanted to add to that, not to interrupt you, but I mean, you look at, we were talking about Nixon and Kissinger. I mean, I think a lot of neocons would look at, I mean, I've spoken to people that I would consider neocons that have said, oh, you know, what Nixon did in 72 with China, that was appeasement. That was appeasement. You know, I've talked to the ambassador who was the negotiator for that, or the translator, Chaz Freeman. And they look at him and they're like, oh, well, he's just an appeaser of China. You know, they are really like, it's beyond hawkish. It's almost like they're like for a nuclear winter.
And the thing is, I've read a lot of the declassified record on Nixon and Kissinger. Anybody who could say that those two guys were soft on communism, I mean, really, I mean, it's look, Richard Nixon had this exalted reputation as being a kind of great statesman, which he was not. Okay, if you read those declassified tapes, which is, they were hard to get out, but they finally did come out. There is almost no difference between Richard Nixon and John Foster Dulles. Almost none. All right. But I will say this. These guys, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and that whole PNAC gang, okay, with Woolsey, they do go a step beyond Nixon. You know, they're actually looking for ways to start a war. They're actually looking for ways to start confrontations. The war on terror is not enough. They want to bring back Cold War I modified into Cold War II. And let me say something. In my article, as anybody who reads the article, I made a comparison there between two Soviet scholars, all right? One was Richard Pipes. One was the late Steve Cohen, all right? There were two different views of the Soviet Union. Pipes was a dyed-in-the-wool core warrior who was part of the whole neocon movement, worked under Reagan on the National Security Council, 1981, 1982. And he said that the communist dictatorship in the Soviet Union was irreversible. It had been destined to be there, et cetera. And therefore, there's no reason for anyone to try and return to a détente with them. Cohen completely disagreed. You know, he looked throughout Soviet history and said, no, that's not the case. There were stages, okay, all right, where the Soviet Union could have changed. He named Bukharin, he named Khrushchev, okay? So then you had Gorbachev. Now, if Gorbachev was not the real deal, I don't know what the heck was, okay? He was clearly... I mean, look, Even the Iron Lady, Margaret Thatcher, said, Gorbachev is for real. This is a guy we can work with. Do you know who advised Reagan not to work with him?
Go on.
Nixon and Kissinger. Nixon and Kissinger. Okay. Because Reagan was impressed by Thatcher, by her assessment, and he was impressed by his talks with Gorbachev.
No,
so he called.
Go on.
He calls in Nixon and Kissinger, and they both advise him no. And in fact, you know what Nixon told the entourage around Reagan after he left the office? He said, "Don't let this guy in the room alone with Gorbachev." Okay. Now, here's my question. If you're to the right of Reagan, how does that make you an appeaser? Nixon and Kissinger, how does that make you? See, this is how completely nuts, how the crackpot realism in this country has won out. Gorbachev was the real deal. Okay, that's what he really was. I mean, he had great ideas, the whole Iceland summit, where he wanted to cut nuclear weapons by 50%. His peace plan for Iraq under H.W. Bush. You know, those were all really good. They were all ignored, all right? And that's what eventually one of the things that led to his fall. Stephen Cohen was right, and Richard Pipes was wrong, all right? And history has dictated that. And Woolsey, of course, is in the Pipes camp. Okay, these guys, I think, you know, not only
I was going to say, too, Woolsey was sort of slinking around during the Cold War too. He was Under Secretary of the Navy, right?
Yes. Right. So he was right in the middle of it. Okay. To me, these guys, it's not just Russia, it's also China. You know, like you said earlier, they want to do that also. I think that's what this agreement is about, that took the French deal away from Australia with the nuclear subs. And then replace it with the United States, Australia, and the United Kingdom. Because I think they want to get Australia into this camp, okay, so that they won't lean towards a New Zealand kind of thing, because New Zealand does not want atomic submarines anywhere in that passageway between Australia and New Zealand. So the deal was for diesel submarines. Okay, so what happened is the Hawks then decided to take that deal away from France and bring Australia into a tripartite agreement with the United Kingdom and the United States. And they're now going to make a deal with atomic submarines. Okay, and I don't know what New Zealand's going to say about that. You know, we'll see what happens here. But I think the obvious point is that they want to make an alliance with Australia because they want a power there in the South Pacific against China.
I was just going to say, I think all of what we're talking about with regards to the neocons and their sort of, they really want to rush to war whenever they can. I think that it may explain why Woolsey has promoted these ideas of, oh, the North Koreans are coming with electromagnetic pulse weapons. Oh, it was the jihadis and Saddam Hussein behind the Oklahoma City bombing. They sort of use these stories as a way to rile people up and hype them up for the potential of war. Now, I'm not saying necessarily that Woolsey doesn't believe his own BS, but part of me wonders sometimes if they sort of craft these narratives that they consider noble lies that have to be told in order to get the plebs to support the wars.
I don't think there's any question about that. I don't think, look, I don't think these guys believe this stuff. I think, you know, going back to Nitsi, okay, when he tried to sell this whole thing about the Soviet Union in 1975, 1976, being this God almighty power, okay, he was wrong about all that stuff, all right? And even people in the MSM eventually called him out on that. It was a way for him to go ahead and create this, what he called the Committee on the Present Danger, in order to go ahead and stop any kind of further détente between the United States and the Soviet Union. And as I wrote in the article, what that did, if you follow contemporary history, and I've said this before, the whole triumph of Cheney and Rumsfeld in 1975 was the ultimate extinction of Kennedy's foreign policy. And that, of course, was the last vestige of any hope of having a detente with the Soviet Union. And, you know, and what makes this so remarkable, it, and this is a wonderful illustration of crackpot realism. There is no Soviet Union anymore. Okay? There is no USSR. All right? We have this country called Russia, which has given up almost all of the provinces it held, okay, in control, both in Eastern Europe, and which were actually former parts of the Soviet Union, like Belarus, like the Baltic states, etc. Those are all not part of Russia anymore, okay? And we have a Soviet society, which is not a communist machine anymore. It's not a communist apparatus. Further, as a, another point I made in that article, instead of this idea that somehow the Soviet Union is tracking westward, it's actually shrunk back, and what is tracked eastward is NATO. All right? So, can we have a little bit of actual historical context here? And but this is how crazy people like Woolsey, you know, want to create this bell, this alarm bell about something that doesn't exist anymore.
So do you think that's sort of the MO for Woolsey, is, you know, presenting this revisionist McCarthyite history of the JFK years and the assassination and the Soviet Union? Do you think that he's doing that to sort of rile up tensions with Russia amongst the public?
Yes.
Okay.
I firmly believe that. And I'll be quite frank about it. You know, excuse my French, I don't think he believes his own bullshit. I really don't think he believes that, you know? And what's really funny is that he was on Fox one night with Laura Ingraham, talking about how somehow the Soviet Union was interfering in Ukraine, okay? And now this is not a fantasy, this really happened. Laura Ingraham actually said to him then, well, hasn't the United States interfered in the internal affairs of other countries? And Woolsey kind of dumbed up and he wouldn't answer the question. Okay, so this is what I mean. I don't think he believes his own bullshit, all right? Okay, I think it's simply what they call a psyop, okay? That's what this book is. Operation Dragon is a psyop. And I don't think, and let me say something else. I don't think it's a coincidence that this book appeared right before what is supposed to be the final declassification of the whole JFK Records Act. I don't think that's a coincidence. Just like I don't think Abrams' book on Jack Ruby, I don't think that was a coincidence either. Right?
No, I you know, I've thought about that too. I mean, we have things like there is a new podcast that's really popular among a lot of younger politically inclined people. It's called Blowback, but season two of that show, it's a pretty mainstream sort of podcast, but they were talking about the Kennedy assassination. So obviously, you know, I think a lot of doors have opened for talking about this, even as there's attempts to sort of keep a lid on discussion of the assassination. And maybe that's why these books like Operation Dragon come out.
What is it? What is that show you're talking about?
Blowback? It's called Blowback. Noah Colwyn. I know that he reads a lot of the JFK books. He's a fan of Peter Dale Scott, but, season two was all about Castro and U.S. foreign policy, and one of the episodes actually dealt with the Kennedy assassination. I'm supposed to have him on to talk about it. I'll have to give you a link to that show. Maybe you could review it.
Yeah, why don't you send it to me? Because there's also this big podcast called TrueAnon.
I'm friends with Brace. I know TrueAnon. TrueAnon's actually, they're friendly with the people that do the Blowback podcast. Yeah.
Yeah. TrueAnon, I had no idea about this network. They're on Patreon, and they have an amazing amount of money comes into them, you know, every month. They're very well-backed, and they try and appeal to young people. And they had a friend of mine, Aaron Good, on. And they said, when he was talking about the Kennedy, he goes, that was one of the most popular shows that we ever had on. Okay. And now Aaron has gone on and he's creating a podcast on the JFK case. All right. Which I think is going to premiere in November, which Abby Martin is going to be the host of. Okay. So when people say that nobody cares about the JFK case anymore, this book, Operation Dragon, shows you how worried they are about just that fact. Okay.
So the last thing I'll say in closing, because I know we went over, my apologies for that, but I just wanted to note, since we were talking about the neocons in addition to Operation Dragon and James Woolsey, I think the problem, when I see people covering Operation Dragon, I've seen a few news outlets cover, I think even more mainstream ones, without pushing back too much on him, they were covering it. And, you know, it really aggravates me because, like I said, he's promoted nonsense before that we talked about earlier. And not only that, but I don't understand why anyone takes these neocons seriously. You were saying how, you know, they actually create support for terrorism, right? I mean, they created a mess in Libya. But I mean, even look at the way that we deal with Iran. I mean, you know, everything we've done to Iran, especially with Trump ripping up the Iran deal, all it did was embolden support for hardliners in Iran. I mean, we've been in Afghanistan for 20 years and we withdraw. But what did we accomplish? You know, we droned them so much that you actually created more support for bringing the Taliban back. We spent 20 years and trillions of dollars on defeating the Taliban. And what happens at the end of those 20 years? Taliban's back in power. So why do we even listen to these sort of figures that are lamenting how we left Afghanistan and saying, oh, we need to be more aggressive with China? It's complete insanity.
By the way, that was another deal that Gorbachev offered that was turned down. When he decided to get out of Afghanistan, he offered the Reagan administration a deal, okay, that he said, I'll be glad to cooperate with you on having a coalition government to sideline the extremists in Afghanistan. And he made a formal offer to create that. And they ended up turning him down. All right. And so, again, these neocons, you know, their idea of victory is total victory. You know, America has to dominate the world, okay? You know, and we have to do it through this war on terror. We have to do it by bringing back the Cold War. And you say, why do people listen to that? Because they are in such high positions of power. Robert Peary, one of the last great journalists in the United States, used to rail against the unbelievable power that the neocons have. And, you know, he used to say that it's completely unjustified for them to be, you know, so many places in so many spots, you know, that manage to control mechanisms of power. You know, it's completely unjustified. I mean, JFK would laugh at these guys. You know, he would get out of my office. You know,
Well, the other thing that just causes me to lose my temper when talking about these figures is, you know, you'll still see a figure like PNAC's Robert Kagan, writing, you know, every 6 or so months, he writes a new article, a new op-ed in Foreign Affairs or Foreign Policy, where he says, we're an empire now, we're a super, or he's the term superpower. So we're a superpower now, and you stupid plebs need to understand that that's what we are, and you have to go and fight the wars for us. And I think to myself, well, Robert Kagan, he's not going to send his kids off to the war. His kids get nice, cushy positions in D.C. You know, it's never, you know, it's like these people have no idea of what war is actually like. And they, you know, they let the expendables go to war while they create all the policies. And then they let their kids do the same.
That's a great example, because Robert Kagan is or was married to Victoria Nuland. And Victoria Nuland was the architect of the whole Ukraine, okay, deal with the United States, which was so nutty and so badly. Take a look at my review of that film, Ukraine on Fire, which Oliver was the executive producer of, okay? And you'll get an idea of just how mad these neocons really are. And this is a perfect example. Kagan was the outside guy working in the press. Nuland, his wife at the time, I don't know if they're still married, was the inside person controlling the embassy there, okay? And who was gonna take over Ukraine, you know, with, you know, when they led this neo-Nazi rebellion, okay, in that province. So yeah, I mean, why people listen to these guys it escapes my, you know, my imagination, because I know what they're about and I know what they want to do. And, you know, and
I was going to say, I think a lot of pundits who aren't as good as the late Robert Perry, I think they just say, oh, James Woolsey, former director of the CIA. And they think, oh, he must be credible.
Like, no. What Nietzsche's idea was and what their not so secret agenda was to bankrupt the country by spending all this money on military and intelligence factors, so there wouldn't be anything left for anything else, for any of the kind of programs that people like Kennedy, okay, people like Martin Luther King, people like Bobby Kennedy, and to a smaller extent, Lyndon Johnson, you know, what they wanted to go ahead and spend that money on. And so by exaggerating this, by creating this nightmarish scenario, it justifies these massive expenditures on the Pentagon and the CIA. The United States spends more money on the military than I believe the next 15 countries put together. Okay.
Right. And if you're spending all the money on the Pentagon, you know,
right,
goodbye social right. programs. And not only
and
that.
You, and if you go ahead and start these crazy wars, like in Iraq, okay, then that's even more money. All right. And Afghanistan, which W. Bush did. All right. And so therefore, you bankrupt the country and you don't have very much money to spend on those kind of, you know, great society, new frontier, New Deal programs. And that's always been their agenda. And they've achieved it. And I hate to say that, but I think that's really the case.
And it's crazy. And
Operation Dragon is an installment on that.
Right. And it's crazy, too, because since we mentioned Abby Martin, she has a documentary coming out on who's the biggest polluter in the world. We worry about global warming. The military. They're the biggest environmental polluter. Yet we put all this money into the Pentagon and the war machine, war state, as you know, our mutual friend Michael Swanson calls it. And, you know, the neocons get their way. I think you're right. And that is what Operation Dragon is about. It's, I think you're right. It's sort of about creating an alternate reality and pushing a narrative that's an alternate reality for the public.
Yeah, that's what they call the elephant in the room that nobody wants to talk about. Okay, but I have to admit that the neocons were victorious in there. They won and they're winning. And the terrible thing is that Obama did not get out of Afghanistan. Obama approved the Libya operation. Obama approved that huge CIA operation in Syria. Okay. And this is what I mean about the fact that the neocon agenda has now spread into the Democratic Party. You know, that Biden got out of Afghanistan. I mean, I give him credit for that. Now I want to see if he's going to get out of Timber Sycamore, okay, and get us out of Syria next, okay, because that should be the next step, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's what, you know, I know people will say, oh, he's an Obama shill, but, Obama's deputy national security advisor, I think he summed it up perfectly when he said, you know, in DC with foreign policy, there is the blob, basically. It's consumed everything. It's neocons in the Republican Party, and now it's infected the Democratic Party.
Yes. And there's, and like I said, this is why I've written about this and I've talked about it. 1975 was the final destruction, the smashing of JFK's foreign policy, you know, and that's, I stand by that statement, you know, it's because it's utterly true.
Well, I want to let you go, Jim. How can my listeners keep up with your work and anything else that, you know, maybe listeners should know is going to be coming out on Kennedys and King?
All right. That's our website, kennedysandking.com. And I think it's a very good website. You know, if you want to stay current on those kind of events, what happened in the 60s. Okay. That's our website. Tune into that. And I think there's going to be some news on JFK Revisited. So keep your ears and eyes open on that one. All right. And there's this, I think it's going to be a 10-part series by Aaron Good, a podcast coming up on the whole. And he has, I already did a show with him. I did a show with him with Zachary Squire, who was the co-screenwriter of the film JFK. And that's going to be one. And I think he has Daniel Ellsberg lined up for his next spot. And I think he's trying to get John Newman and Jamie Galbraith on his Vietnam one. So that should be a very interesting podcast series.
Well, I look forward to that. Thank you again, Jim DiEugenio.
Thank you so much. Have a good night.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jim DiEugenio of the Kennedys and King website. Be sure to keep an eye out for the documentary he wrote for Oliver Stone, JFK Revisited, Through the Looking Glass. As always, if you can, please, 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 please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There's a $1, $5, $10, and $15 tier. Any amount will help, and given that I do this as my full-time occupation, my full-time job, it is you, dear listener, who helps in large part to keep this show afloat. So if you appreciate my work, please consider making a monthly donation to my Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. And now for the producer's credit shoutout, which is given to my $10 and $15 tier supporters on each and every edition of Parallax Views. Producers credit shoutouts to Mark Arlen, Spartacus Gunner, Ed Gratz, James, Mickey, Brian, The War Nerd, TJ, Nick, Emilia, Chase, Chris, Orc, Black Tuna, Catherine, Nathan, David, Holland, Martin, Brian S., and Jeffrey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at, again, patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.